You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
What a disciplined audience this is. Well, ladies and gentlemen, good morning and welcome to Brookings. I'm John Allen, and I'm the president of the institution, and it is a true pleasure to have you all with us here today. Before I begin my remarks, I'd first like to warmly welcome Ann and Bob Bass, who are here with us this morning, to celebrate the launch of the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking. In establishing this new center, they lend their names to 100 years of scholarship, independence, and impact. On behalf of the entire Brookings community, I'd like to offer our sincere gratitude to Ann and Bob for your support and your partnership. And I'd also like to acknowledge both Amy Liu, our Vice President for Metropolitan Policy Programs, the home of the Bass Center, and Jennifer Vey, the Center Director and Senior Fellow in the Metro Program. This morning's launch is particularly significant for me, in any case, because it is the first center to be launched under my tenure as the president of the institution, and I'm really pleased for this moment. Today, the Bass Center is one of four named centers at the institution, joining what is a small but venerable group of leaders and scholars conducting some of the most impactful and significant and meaningful policy research at Brookings. However, the Bass Center is unique in many and important ways among its peers. Housed in the Metropolitan Policy Program, the center will achieve its mission by working closely with other organizations and individuals, including the Partnership for Public Spaces and the National Main Street Center, all while engaging the public, private, and civic sectors of leaders across the country in its important work. And we welcome both of those other organizations to Brookings here today for this meaningful moment. Partnership is not only the core of the Bass Center's DNA, it is an essential part of how complex problems are solved at the city and at the community level. And I look forward to seeing the indelible mark that this center will make on American cities, large and small, particularly as they work with this vast and impressive network of local government leadership all across the country. With that, let me officially and publicly recognize Ann and Bob Bass for their extraordinary generosity and their timely investment in the Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking. Their support ensures that cities and towns across America have access to Brookings' finest scholars and lasting partnerships that will ensure more vibrant and inclusive communities for all. Today, with Ann's and Bob's support, and with the close partnership of Amy Liu and the Center Director, Jennifer Vey, we embark upon a new journey that contributes to the ongoing story of America's urban renewal. Ann and Bob, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you. So now let me welcome our honored keynote speaker for today's launch, Carol Coletta from the Kresge Foundation. Just this past spring, Carol was named the head of the Memphis River Parks Partnership, a nonprofit organization that manages and maintains 5 miles of riverfront parks on behalf of the city of Memphis. Additionally, Carol serves as a senior fellow in the Kresge Foundation's American Cities Project, leading a proposed $40 million collaboration of foundations, nonprofits, and governments to demonstrate the ways in which a connected set of civic assets can yield increased and more widely shared prosperity and cities for cities and neighborhoods. Carol will begin today's discussion and will be followed by a presentation from Brookings Senior Fellow and Center Director Jennifer Vey, then an exceptional panel of experts and practitioners will join us on the stage. And after that panel, we'll go out to all of you, the audience, for your questions and our answers. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's going to be a wonderful discussion One final housekeeping note, if I may. We are broadcasting this event live on webcast, so to the many viewers coming in over webcast, you are most welcome with us this morning. And as with all public events in this auditorium, today's event is open to the press, and it is on the record. With that, I couldn't be more honored than to welcome to the stage Carol Coletta.
Thank you so much. Let me add my thanks to Robert and Ann Bass for this important new undertaking here at Brookings under the leadership of Amy and Jennifer. You know, placemaking has received a lot of attention over the last couple of decades. In addition to Brookings' important work on innovation districts, organizations including Congress for the New Urbanism, Smart Growth America, of course, Project for Public Spaces, National Main Street Center, Art Place America, Funders Network, I could go on, Urban Land Institute, among many others, have taken up the cause of making better places. You would think by now we would have figured this out, but somehow we haven't. There's a lot more to learn, and that's why I'm so excited about the center. You know, these organizations are tackling placemaking at multiple scales, from region to city to town to district to neighborhood, to a single block, to a single corner. And we probably need them all because, again, we still have so much to learn about good placemaking. Jennifer, I know, is going to tell us about some of the forces that are shaping the places we live and work today. You all know what those are: technology, demographics, changing consumer taste. But as places are shaped, so too are possibilities. See, I think it's easy to make great places for people with a lot of money. I think if you can access the money, I think it's even easy to make great places, or at least good places, for people without a lot of financial means. But what's hard, I believe, is to make places of possibility. Places of possibility where people of different ethnicities, different ages, different abilities, different sexual orientation, and especially different incomes can feel equally at home and equally welcome. But it's not even enough to get people with different backgrounds to occupy space. That's a start. It's important. But it's not enough. Places of possibility, I believe, are those places that lure people into mixing with those who are different, not because they're forced to, not because they're demonstrating progressive values, but they mix because it is delightful to do so. And those are the kinds of places we have to learn to make. Unfortunately, we're really bad at mixing, and we are becoming increasingly so. So I said it was hard. It is. Almost a third of us now live in neighborhoods that are where everyone is rich or everyone is poor. Now, think about that, a third of us. The number of poor people living in urban neighborhoods where the poverty level is greater than 40% has doubled since 2000. And despite what we read in the urban press, there are far more neighborhoods that are declining than are gentrifying. Again, contrary, very much contrary to what we read. And maybe that's because maybe the gentrification story dominates because the flood of college-educated millennials into city centers today is so visible, with their relative affluence and the expansion of consumption driven by their disposable incomes. College-educated millennials are easy to spot, they're easy to caricature, and they're easy to resent, which is, I believe, a real shame, because our cities need those college-educated people. We need them for their income. We need them for their talent. But while millennials are repopulating downtowns, middle neighborhoods are disappearing. I know there are people in this room who are working on that directly. Cities are becoming more and more polarized between the well-to-do and the poor and struggling. The big sort is on. And it's now rare for people of different incomes to live near each other, especially African Americans of different incomes. And so all of that economic polarization that's going on today has devastating consequences for children who are growing up in low-income families. The demographic makeup of a neighborhood makes a difference on generational mobility, and it turns out the worst place to be poor, the worst place to grow up poor, is in a poor neighborhood. It's hard, if not impossible, from poor neighborhoods to access opportunity. Jobs are often far away, and good transportation can be hard to come by. Recently, I was at a concert featuring Keb Moe, the blues artist Keb Moe, and the saxophonist Kirk Whalum. I can see some people in this room have very good musical taste. The head's nodding. So they were in a back and forth about where inspiration for lyrics comes from. And Kirk, using, I think, lyricist shorthand to explain empathy, said, well, if you can't see them, you can't feel them. And that pretty much explains where we are with placemaking today. We are so economically segregated that we don't see our neighbors, and thus we cannot feel our neighbors, leading to a loss of trust, a loss of empathy, and increasing tribalism. That is, I believe, at the heart of a developing crisis, if not a crisis that has fully arrived in our cities and in our nation. Clearly, the forces of division and polarization are not going to sort themselves out naturally. So that's why this center is so important. I think we have to ask ourselves, what is the role of transformative placemaking in creating communities where people can be seen, can be felt, and can have more opportunity for themselves and their families? In other words, how do we make places of possibility? I hope that's what the Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking will help us all figure out, because the trend is moving in the opposite direction. Brookings, of course, occupies this unique position of influence, both to find solutions and then encourage the integration of those solutions into federal policy and to encourage adoption locally. The Metropolitan Policy Program has demonstrated very powerfully its ability to get smart memes into the national conversation. And I hope that the Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking will have that same kind of effect. As you begin your work, I'd like to offer just some quick thoughts on where I think there may be some promising areas of inquiry. I want to point out four. The first is around scale. How can we move beyond the single project, the single district, to connect an entire city to opportunity? I think, again, we've demonstrated we can do it at a small scale. I think the question is, can we really do it at mass scale? And because it's tempting to slice and dice this work, this question of how can we really get to inclusion? It's easy to slice and dice it to smaller geographies because I think that's what we can get our arms around, and often that's the scale at which we can demonstrate this kind of work and execute it. But we need policy, and again, that's what Brookings is so good at. We need policy that recognizes places of possibility must exist for people throughout our communities, for the whole community, if placemaking is truly to be transformative. I think a second question worthy of exploration by the center is this. Can we fundamentally redefine infrastructure to include the civic commons? We're beginning to hear a renewed drumbeat for a big infrastructure plan, $500 billion. But the default definition of infrastructure, and you know this, is roads and bridges, with an occasional nod to transit thrown in. But our civic infrastructure, our parks, our libraries, our community centers, our rec centers, they are in abysmal shape. And in so many ways, that is the infrastructure that underpins an inclusive community. I think if we could redefine infrastructure to include parks and public spaces and civic assets that could bring us all together, that would help mitigate some of the exclusion that is going on both by policy, consumer preference, and decisions we're making every day, some of which we don't even recognize. For too long, we've invested in infrastructure that tear, like freeways, that tear communities apart. There's been one estimate by Nathan Baumsnow that each additional highway constructed through a center city reduced its population by 18%. What if we could invest in infrastructure that did just the opposite, that increased population in the center city by 20% because of the allure of the civic infrastructure? I think it's a good question for this center. A third possible line of inquiry is, can we make housing truly affordable? We know it's critical to creating and maintaining inclusive neighborhoods. Could we tap the emerging grassroots YIMBY movement, yes, in my backyard, where people welcome additional development in their neighborhoods? It's really a next-gen movement of people who are advocating and organizing to build places where everyone is included. What a refreshing movement. Can we tap it? Can we link on to that kind of thinking, that kind of energy in the next generation, and use it for building affordable housing and inclusive communities? What will it take to create and sustain truly mixed income communities? It takes housing, yes. It takes affordable housing, yes. But it takes more than housing units. It takes, I believe, carefully cultivating places where people can come together as equals, as we are doing, trying to do on the Memphis Riverfront, as artist The Astor Gates is attempting to do on Chicago's South Side, as Houston, I believe, is doing with its Bayou Greenways project, as groups of collaborators are doing to reimagine the Civic Commons in Philadelphia, in Detroit, in Akron. As a Kresge-loaned executive working on the riverfront in my hometown of Memphis, a city that is majority African American in a county that's majority African American in a metro region that is half African American, I can tell you that managing for mixing requires a bundle of small precision moves that are more error than trial. Tribalism in all forms runs very strong, and we have to design for mixing, staff for mixing, welcome for mixing, program for mixing. We have so much to learn. Can we challenge the anti-gentrification rhetoric head on and promote tools to capture a portion of new value where it's created to build both affordable housing and support the civic commons in revitalized neighborhoods? And then one more question. Can we create both a persuasive political argument and a seductive consumer proposition to make diverse mixed-income communities that are essential to creating equity? You know the work of Stanford professor Raj Chetty. He's shown that the best predictor of intergenerational mobility for children in low-income families is the employment rate of adults in their neighborhood. It turns out it's not proximity to jobs that matters. What matters is living close to lots of neighbors with jobs. So can we make those kinds of neighborhoods today? We used to. Can we learn to do it again? In other words, the Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking has its hands full with critical and fascinating questions to answer. Jennifer, I look forward to what you will discover that will inform the work of that we're trying to do in Memphis and people are trying to do in cities and communities all over this country to make places of possibility for all Americans. Thanks.
Place has always mattered to people and economies, but the demands for place have shifted over time. During the 19th century, much of our economic activity was concentrated in the downtowns and the industrial districts of the nation's growing cities. This changed in the 20th century, however, as the advent of the automobile helped drive economic activity and deconcentrate economic activity to the suburbs. In the last several decades, the pendulum has begun to shift back as there's greater demand for certain urban attributes, proximity, density, and walkability. But a lot of that activity is happening in places like waterfront areas or other high amenity districts, often fueled by investments designed to attract highly educated workers. We need this kind of growth to work better for more people and for more places.
Well, I think it's fundamentally an equity issue, whether we have an economy that works for everyone or just for big cities or certain areas within big cities. It's fundamentally about the opportunity for people to make a better future for themselves.
It all starts by recognizing the potential in people. If we're not investing in black and brown people, then we can always figure out ways to invest in place and not people.
You know, you can think of placemaking as the entire experience between the time you leave your home and arrive at your destination. So if you think about it, it's incredibly important what that fabric means to a person.
One of the real opportunities we see, particularly in places that are struggling, whether they're in an urban context or in a more rural or smaller setting, is the value of their downtowns or their neighborhood commercial districts. Those are places that often there's some degree of economic activity that's already happening there that can be leveraged. They also represent an enormous investment over time of a community's resources. They often have affordable space. They have flexible space. They're dense. They're walkable. They have many of the attributes that we know workers and residents really value today.
Public, private, and civic sector leaders need to understand the unique challenges and the unique opportunities facing different kinds of economic districts, whether that's downtowns or university and medical districts, arts and creative areas, rural main streets, or even suburban districts. And then they need to target their investments to better address the needs of those places.
You can take the example of Campus Martius in Detroit. Downtown Detroit is a miracle of development and reinvestment that no one could ever have envisioned just a few years ago.
What I think the Bass Center can do is to figure out ways we can get everyone involved to realize the principle that we're all in this together.
Through both quantitative and on-the-ground research, the New Bass Center will both demonstrate and advance the idea that place matters to people and economies. The center will work with a range of stakeholders to help document and design model approaches to transformative placemaking. And finally, the center will help facilitate systemic policy and investment reforms that better support place-led economic growth and help innovative placemaking solutions to scale.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Before I get started, first, I really want to thank President Allen for his warm remarks, Carol Coletta for her inspiring and really pitch-perfect speech, and to our panelists, whom you will hear from shortly, for sharing their experiences and their insights with us. I also want to thank Amy Liu and my colleagues at Brookings, who've been so supportive as we've prepared for this day. And, of course, offer a very special thank you for the generosity of Bob and Ann Bass, who have made all of this possible. Finally, many thanks to you for being here today or for sharing the event with us via the webcast. So, today the Metropolitan Policy Program is very excited to be launching the new Ann T. and Robert N. Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking. Each of you is participating in this event to learn more about the center and its ambitions. But you are also here because you care about place. It's a universal truth that place matters to all of us, deeply impacting how, where, and with whom we spend our time, our ability to get from here to there, and our overall physical and emotional well-being. But place also matters to the economy, to the growth and success of businesses, workers, and our communities. So that brings me to the three reasons we are launching the Bass Center at this place, the Brookings Metro Program, and at this time. First, while place has always mattered to people and economies, new technologies and demographic trends are altering the demands for place. We need to better understand those demands and what they mean for our communities now and in the future. Second, we already know these trends are having many positive impacts, but those benefits are not being equally distributed. Rather, the knowledge economy is leaving too many people and too many places behind. And so the third reason we are launching the center. If market and demographic trends are to work for more people and places, public, private, and civic sector leaders need transformative investments in places and placemaking to be a key part of their solution set. First, we know that new technologies and demographic trends are changing the needs and the demands for place. As you heard me say in the video, the relationship between place and the economy is constantly evolving. In the 19th century, America's cities grew to become not only centers of commerce and trade, but powerhouses of invention and of industry. Within these cities, the variable needs of consumer-serving artisans, retailers and other businesses, large manufacturing firms and workers determined where and how they clustered, giving rise to the growth of downtowns and industrial districts. The demands for place dramatically changed during the 20th century, however. The advent of the automobile, coupled with new infrastructure investments, housing and land use policies, and the shifting demands of industry led to the move of people and jobs from central cities to greener and whiter suburban pastures, while leaving many urban communities in decline and in distress. This changing relationship between place and economy has given us the varied patterns of concentration, of dispersion, and of racial and economic segregation that still characterize our cities and our suburbs today. But these patterns aren't static. As with past innovations, today's digital revolution is enabling the creation of new products, services that have the potential to improve our health, our environment, and our overall quality of life. But the digital revolution is also causing disruptive impacts on our growth and our development patterns. First, the desire for greater collaboration among firms and workers, together with a rise in the sharing economy, is causing higher demands for levels of density and proximity that facilitate interaction and exchange of ideas, as well as physical items, from housing to transportation to tools. Further, as more shoppers go online, the country's retail landscape is being shaken. Many brick and mortar establishments located in drivable suburban shopping malls are becoming obsolete, while growing e-commerce establishments are exhibiting mixed patterns of both sprawl and concentration. These trends will continue to have potent impacts on how and where we shop and work. Finally, the rise of flexible and remote work is changing companies' needs for fixed office space. While the full implications of these shifts are yet unknown, they don't bode very well for many existing office developments, particularly isolated or poorly designed back offices whose purpose is becoming increasingly irrelevant. Meanwhile, the growing number of untethered workers to work and to meet where they want means that co-working spaces and flexible offices will compete for well-connected, amenity-rich locations with good Wi-Fi, gathering spaces, and active programming. All of these disruptions that are being caused by the digital revolution are occurring in tandem with a powerful demographic revolution that is having its own complementary impacts on place, with a diversifying population and changing household structures, leading to increased demand for more walkable, vibrant communities in which to live, work, and recreate. These trends are yielding many positive impacts. After decades of sprawl and suburban dominance, many U.S. cities are experiencing rebounding populations, growing employment, and new public and private sector investments in infrastructure, real estate, and placemaking. This revitalization is leading to new or revitalized areas of economic activity, particularly in historic downtowns, along waterfronts, and more recently in innovation districts where research institutions and entrepreneurs cluster and connect. These trends are also leading to the rapid rise of more mixed-use, walkable suburban districts. For cities and other communities suffering from years of jobs and population loss, these trends have brought some really welcome impacts. Chris Leinberger and his colleagues at George Washington University have demonstrated that walkable places yield strong premiums in housing, retail, and office rents over those in more drivable suburban areas, which in turn can have a positive fiscal impact on regenerating places. Joe Courtwright and his colleagues at City Observatory have also shown that the density and vitality of cities impacts wages, with educated workers living in urban areas earning far more than their rural counterparts. Finally, new evidence shows that density and proximity can generate more innovation. In a 2017 Brookings report, Scott Andes found that universities located in downtown areas outpace non-urban universities on a range of innovation indicators, from licensing deals to the number of startups, which might help explain why advanced industry firms and entrepreneurs are increasingly moving to be in the orbit of these institutions. And yet, for all these positive effects, we know that the knowledge economy is also leaving far too many people and too many places behind. In the first place, the knowledge economy is favoring tech-oriented workers over those without digital skills. Brookings research has shown that workers in highly digital occupations like software developers or even financial managers far out-earn those in low digital occupations like cooks or security guards. More than that, these higher wages are disproportionately going to some groups of workers over others. For example, while Black, Latino, and Asian workers comprise 37% of the U.S. workforce, they represent almost 50% of those employed in low-tech jobs like personal care aides, food service, and construction. Conversely, several of these groups are significantly underrepresented in higher-skilled, higher-wage occupations. Unfortunately, many younger Black and Hispanic workers, which are a growing segment of our workforce, lack the education needed to move up the occupational ladder and fill positions left by aging baby boomers, a fact which threatens both their and the nation's long-term economic success. But not only are these inequities impacting people, they're dividing places too. Across the country, the digital economy is rewarding large global centers that are attracting innovative companies and highly educated workers, while many older industrial cities and heartland communities, particularly small and mid-sized cities and rural towns, struggle to keep pace. We witnessed this superstar city phenomenon playing out this week, with Amazon announcing that it will locate its new headquarters in the New York City and DC regions here in Arlington, two very big metros that, as my colleague Alan Berube has shown, also have the largest pools of tech workers in the nation. Many of these same trends are playing out within regions. Recent research by the Economic Innovation Group show how prosperous areas within metros have been adding firms and jobs, while other communities continue to face decline and disinvestment. In many regions, these trends are reinforcing or even exacerbating the spatial disparities created by decades of housing and land use policies and practices that devalued, segregated, and sometimes physically destroyed low-income and minority communities. Meanwhile, in many strong market areas, low- and moderate-income residents can no longer afford to live in neighborhoods that are in or near growing job hubs, limiting their ability to physically access employment. So, all this brings me to the third reason we are launching the Bass Center. As I've described, major market and demographic forces are altering the demands for place, yielding rewards for some people and for some communities. But in an era marked by stark inequities, by income and wealth, by race and ethnicity, by geography, local and regional leaders from big cities to small towns are hungry to harness these forces in ways that produce more widespread economic benefits. This provides both an urgency and a tremendous opportunity to reimagine our approach to place and to help communities invest in transformative solutions, in transformative placemaking, at a scale and with an ambition to meet the needs of businesses and of people wherever they live and work. This means investing in a range of areas where new approaches to transformative placemaking have the potential to leverage existing assets in new and powerful ways. For example, it will mean making transformative placemaking investments in small and mid-sized rural communities, like Newcastle, Wyoming, which are looking to reverse job and population loss by remaking their downtown main streets, diversifying their economies through tourism, locally grown entrepreneurship, and a focus on the arts and creative enterprises, all the while leveraging the perks of small-town living. It will mean making transformative placemaking investments in culturally rich urban communities, like the Bronzeville community in Chicago, whose existing economic and physical assets make them well-positioned for job and business growth, yet which continue to be challenged by the lasting effects of disinvestment and discriminatory policies and practices that have stymied economic opportunity. It will mean making transformative placemaking investments in suburban research and business parks, like Columbia Gateway in Maryland, where sterile, car-centric design patterns that worked, frankly, quite well for many decades are no longer meeting the needs of many tenants and workers, putting them at a competitive disadvantage to more dynamic urban economic districts. And it will mean making transformative placemaking investments in growing economic districts, like the downtown Chattanooga Innovation District, for example, where investments in physical and economic assets are driving rapid residential and job growth, but which are feeling the pressures of rising real estate values and the risk of social and economic exclusion. Finally, it will mean understanding the needs and dynamics of other types of economic districts, of hospital districts, urban manufacturing districts, arts districts, market and food districts, where place and placemaking is or has the potential to bring people together, to generate creativity and new ideas, and drive economic growth that is equitable and inclusive. But we can't get there from here. For decades, planners, community development groups, and other place-focused organizations and practitioners have worked to elevate the importance of place and placemaking in fostering more economically, socially, and environmentally responsible development. Indeed, over the past several decades, the Main Street and smart growth movements have helped leaders understand that reinvesting in existing communities is fiscally and ecologically more sustainable than promoting sprawl. The community development field has long engaged in place-based efforts to revitalize distressed urban neighborhoods and better the lives of their residents. And the work of Project for Public Spaces and other organizations has helped the very word placemaking gain ever-increasing currency among community and civic leaders who are working to foster greater community engagement, enhance and activate the public realm, promote better health, or otherwise improve quality of life. Yet for all their positive impacts, these efforts are constrained by policies, practices, and investment structures that are failing to keep pace with the changing needs of firms, institutions, and workers, hampering the scope and the scale of their impact. In short, we need new knowledge, new practices and tools, and new policies and investment strategies that better support place-led development. Transformative placemaking first requires new knowledge. Working with national and local researchers and practitioners and tapping into the expertise that exists here at Brookings, the Bass Center aims to expand what we know about the new demands for place, deeply exploring such questions as what do businesses and workers in different sectors of the economy need today from place? In what ways will this continue to influence the geography of regional business and job growth? And how should all this inform where and how to prioritize infrastructure, economic development, and placemaking investments within cities and regions? Transformative placemaking requires new practices and new tools. Working with leaders and practitioners on the ground in economic districts across the country, the Bass Center will investigate what placemaking investments are driving transformative impacts and how can they be tailored to other communities. How do we design and implement creative new placemaking practices that help grow local businesses and jobs, foster innovation, and improve access, opportunity, and engagement? And how can the next generation of place management organizations help break down existing policy and practice silos to drive these outcomes? Finally, transformative placemaking requires new integrated policies and investment strategies to support and connect economic districts in ways that increase economic growth and opportunity. Working with state and regional economic development, planning, and infrastructure professionals, the Bass Center will aim to reform the way we regulate and invest in our places, focusing on such big questions as, how do we revamp outmoded land use policies to support dynamic economic districts instead of auto-dependent sprawl? How can transportation investments be targeted to create more walkable, bikeable, and connected economic districts? And how can economic development investments be more intentional and less reactive to the latest new program, think empowerment zones, promise zones, or more recently, opportunity zones, or new windfall opportunity, think Amazon HQ2. Through all these efforts and working in close collaboration with Project for Public Spaces and the National Main Street Center, the Bass Center for Transformative Placemaking will inspire public, private, and civic sector leaders to make transformative place investments that generate widespread social and economic benefits. William Holly White once said, "The spectacle of people following current custom for lack of will or imagination to do anything else is hardly a new failing." We should read these words not as a lament for the often slow embrace of new ideas, nor should we use them as an excuse to idly fall back on the practices of the past. Rather, we should see this quote as motivation to summon the will and use our collective imaginations to create a better place-led future. The Bass Center hopes to do just that by undertaking new analysis, engaging in communities, and building a broad network of change makers working in and for communities around the country. We hope that you will join us in our efforts. Thank you. I'd now like to call up my fabulous colleague, Adi Brookings Fellow, Adi Tomer, and our amazing group of panelists.
That was pretty good. I feel like Carol just told us to be good neighbors, and some of you said it. So we'll do it one more time in the spirit of placemaking and neighborliness, right? So good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. There, all right. Now the webcast can hear you all. They can know you're here. First of all, thank you for coming. Welcome to the Brookings Institution. Thank you to President Allen for the introduction. Thank you, of course, to Carol and Jennifer for those opening remarks. We are so excited to have you here. We have an amazing collection of panelists, and we have so much ground to cover. So we're going to get pretty much right into it. My name is Adi Tomer. I lead our infrastructure work here at the Metro Program. So as I like to say when I'm on the road talking about infrastructure and real estate and economic development, infrastructure and those topics are brothers from another mother, which means that you cannot have one without the other. So I am so interested to learn what everyone has to say here. Speaking of digital technology, I need to have my notes ready. So I'm going to introduce everyone really quick, and then we're going to start off with some kind of responses, I think, to this really powerful framework that Jennifer put out. So to my immediate left is Patrice Fry, who's the president and CEO of National Main Street Center. She helps manage a network, this is astonishing, of over 1,100 communities across the country. In over 30 years, if I'm getting these numbers right, National Main Street Center has helped renew 2,000 older commercial districts, which is just an astonishing achievement of helping to remake America. And she has come to us today from Chicago, Illinois. So to her left is Alyssa Gertler, who's the Planning and Development Director at Metro. I love these lines from what she did when she took over this current role at Metro. She thinks that to build a strong planning department requires connections, relationships, leadership, and action. So should we all be so lucky to live in a region with an MPO that has that kind of leadership in the planning department, honestly. Then to her left is, and of course she's from Portland, Oregon, Sean Pierce is the Director of Economic Development and Inclusion Policy for the city of Minneapolis. I want to say that title one more time because you don't normally hear that, but whether at the city or regional scale. She is the Director of Economic Development and Inclusion Policy. So a huge, huge responsibility and a huge thank you, of course, to the city of Minneapolis for taking on that kind of responsibility. In a prior life, Sean also worked for Greater MSP, which means she's been on the corporate civic side of the equation as well. So we're really excited to have your input here. And again, of course, she's in from Minneapolis. And then finally, to her left, but certainly not least, Rob Stewart, who's the Executive Vice Chairman of JBG Smith's Board of Trustees. JBG Smith is a publicly traded REIT and an absolute powerhouse in Greater Washington real estate development. You may not know their name. Many of you in this room probably do, but some people probably don't. Chances are, though, either you or someone you know lives in their one of their buildings or works in one of their buildings. So they are really undergirding this regional economy. And Rob has been with JBG since 1988. So long experience in the region. And of course, he's here from Washington. Now, I'm emphasizing at the end of all of those conversations where people are from. I hail from here in Washington. I'm originally from Florida. So we've got basically every region of the country represented on this dais or whatever you want to call it up here. And that matters because I think what Jennifer put out here is a powerful statement about how demographic and other economic development forces are changing across the country. They're influencing place in different ways. So where I want to start with is how are you seeing these demographic and economic forces impacting the communities where either you work now or even places where maybe you grew up and you get a chance to go back and visit and you see them play out and creating kind of divergent paths based on place? So let me start with Patrice. We'll go down the line. And then after we do that, we'll get a much more free-flowing conversation going.
Great. Thank you.
No. Okay.
There, now we can.
There we go. Okay, great. Well, thank you for the warm introduction. And the National Main Street Center, we work with a diverse network of communities, but particularly with rural communities. About 70%, 80% of that network is smaller town or rural. And so, you know, broadly speaking, it's that rural communities are not monolithic. Many of them are doing okay, but it is true that the vast majority of the of rural communities, rural counties, have lost population in the last 10 or 20 years. They have seen a decline in economic growth. You can draw a direct line from those outcomes to really significant macroeconomic forces that we see play out. So that's offshoring of manufacturing, changes in technology, which means sometimes our employers need much fewer employees than they once did. And then significant changes in the extraction industry, which have really hurt many rural communities, particularly in Appalachia. So broadly speaking, again, you can say that these are places that have seen a real decline in economic opportunity in recent years and where there has been an accompanying decline in quality of life. So I think what's exciting about today's conversation and the work that will be happening through the Bass Center is that I think it helps us to understand what is working, what's working where, and how we can scale those solutions.
Hi, everyone. I'm from Portland, Oregon, or you might know it as Portlandia, home of DIY everything, maker spaces, bike mechanics, food trucks, mountains and rivers, clean air and water. Perhaps that might be the reason we have such a strong base of outdoor apparel manufacturers like Nike, Columbia Sportswear. It's the place where the urban growth boundary was innovative in drawing a line around urban sprawl to protect farms and forests that clearly have made livability our competitive advantage, as we say. It has also been called our second paycheck because we don't have the wages. And so we try to use a second paycheck of livability instead. And what that also means is we're sort of the poster child for many of the things that you heard both Carol and Jennifer talk about today in terms of affordable housing issues, displacement issues, a missing middle where there's a huge divide between the tech workers of our region and those who are being left behind. We have a beautiful vision called the 2040 vision that was groundbreaking urban planning 25 years ago, but for whom? And so you look now at our beautiful infrastructure and all of the buildings and you wonder, what did we do for the people? And so I'll just leave you with this one anecdote, which many of you may know Portland for its food trucks. The first food trucks block downtown, which has incubated many small businesses, is now being knocked down, and we're putting up our first five-star hotel. So I think we can talk more about what that might mean for our region.
Good morning, everyone. How are you?
Good morning.
Beautiful. Pleasure to be with you all. I have I have the honor of serving the people of Minneapolis under the leadership of Mayor Fry, and I'll just say quickly that, you know, he has really three priorities in his first term, and they are affordable housing, police community relations, and economic inclusion. And in my role, I've had many roles where I get to really analyze what it means to be a part of such a prosperous region, a region where we have per capita one of the largest number of Fortune 500 companies, where we have incredible livability and access to resources, and where we have some of the worst disparities in the United States. It is not without great verbal commitment to economic inclusion that this has happened. And so part of our realities and dynamics is that while we've talked about inclusion, while we've talked about closing the gap, while we've talked about ending the racial divide, the bias amongst our employers, the bias and the civic infrastructure has actually led to over 130,000 job vacancies in our region. 130,000 job vacancies. We have twice as many people available to put to work. So that tells you that this is not because we are without people, but it's because we continue to overlook the very people who are bouncing from employment opportunity to employment opportunity, who've been seeking access to our companies, to our civic infrastructure, and who continue to be ignored. So that's part of our reality. The other piece that I like to start with reminding us is that actually we're all on stolen land. And as we talk about a return to the country that we once knew, this changing demographic, this has actually always been the demographic of our nation, right? There have always been people of color. Our country has a history of changing our immigration policies according to our need for workers. And so where we're at right now as a region is really trying to figure out what it means to reinvest in the communities that actually built our nation. Right. To make sure that when we make investment in place, we're not making investment, to your point, in just buildings and infrastructure, but that we're making investments in people. And so that includes changing the way that we think about our financial tools, from just buying new real estate to infusions of working capital. Instead of saying, hey, amazing bank that we've worked with for 30, 40, 50, 60 years, we're going to also work with the financial institutions that are being led by the most impacted communities. Because even as we, again, continue to have the commitment, we know that our access to capital continues to be one of our largest barriers in the Twin Cities. And that has meant that as we see a booming housing market, as we see more companies moving, starting, or growing in our region, that in fact people of color don't have an entry in, right? Because they can't get that access to capital. There isn't that access to the family member or to the business partner to start the new endeavor, to invest in the people, et cetera. And so our work, which we'll talk about a little bit later, is really on reclaiming the right for people of color to exist in these places. It is working with our suburban and rural counterparts to acknowledge that we're actually all in this together, and to making sure that affordable housing isn't a conversation but is a part of our investment strategy.
Great. How are you? I'm Rob Stewart. The reason I'm up here is I spent 30 years working on mixed-use development fundamentally with a firm that over that 30 period grew to respond to that opportunity. So I spent my life in pro formas, understanding the economics and figuring out ways to make money fundamentally for our investors who, though their endowments and foundations primarily are mostly about, as it relates to us, having us make money for them. I've observed over that period that the system that we operate in really does promote the segregation of our community by income, and it has over that period grown to drive the cost of housing and other uses in urban environments up dramatically. So it's made our region, as successful as it is, that much more expensive and that much more inhospitable to people of lesser means. So for the next 30 years, I hope our firm is about the business of trying to make these places more inclusive and more diverse. And as some of you may know, we have a phenomenal opportunity to do that in Crystal City, where we will now house the Amazon HQ2, which I won't digress on right now. That may be why Brooklyn brought me up here. They had no foresight, though. So in any event, I think, in fact, in the past, all these trends are actually not done concentrating people by income and wealth. And if we don't take steps to change the rules, we're going to get more of that as time goes on. So I have some specific thoughts on that, but I won't bore you with them right now. I'll wait until the question comes up or the opportunity presents itself.
There's nothing boring about what you were saying. Look, many of us probably in this audience, or even maybe your expectations coming in today, we're going to talk about place, and that has a physical element to it. I think what's so exciting about what all four of you said, what Jennifer and Carol said in introduction, people were at the center of it, right? You saw it in the video, too. That's a powerful difference, right, than maybe many of our expectations. So let's focus for a second on inclusion here. What are the ways in each of your communities, or as you view the country, right, that you see place-based policies creating barriers to economic opportunity, right? And Patrice, not just because you started last time, I actually want to start with you right here, because I think we tend to think about these, especially from national media reporting, with good reason, right, as a big city issue. But this isn't just a big city issue, right? We see this all across the country, communities of all sizes, yeah.
Yeah, and there are a couple things that I would point to there. And the first is access to capital in rural America. We have seen a real contraction in the availability of capitals, particularly for real estate, but also for small business investing in rural America since the Great Recession. It is extraordinarily challenging to get small deals done in rural America, and all there are small deals. So I think the big banks are much less interested. Community banks have shrunk in number. I think there are things that we can and need to be doing differently. I personally would like to see maybe the federal government lean a little bit more on our major lenders to be more engaged in rural areas. But there are also more creative things we can be doing, I think, from a regulatory perspective with for some credit unions, small banks, to help ease the flow of capital. The other thing that I would raise, which, again, we tend to think of it as a big city issue, and it's a rural issue, is housing. Federal government every year invests handsomely in rural housing. It is very difficult to do that in a smart way under current federal programs. And if we were doing it in a smart way, we would absolutely make sure that that housing was going downtown, or at least a portion of it was, to really capitalize on the other investments that need to be happening in downtowns.
What are other ways you see in each of your communities, right? Let's say beyond even just necessarily housing or access to capital, or how much is that? That's the kind of number, that's the check mark we keep hearing about as well.
Yeah, I'd say broad scale, we really do need to rethink our underwriting criteria of our financial institutions. And that is well beyond what any city can do, but the fact of the matter is that most of our country still is redlined. And so that has a direct impact on, for us, where we can make investments, because, in fact, where we have the greatest amount of available real estate happens to be in communities of color. I say happens to be, but we know that's intentional, right? And the city of Minneapolis has a 1935 planning map that designated an entire quadrant of our city as a Negro slum. And that's where blacks and Jews were intended to live. And, in fact, that is where blacks and Jews were for many years, and where it's still predominantly black and immigrant communities. And so part of our solution right now is to say, hey, since we haven't changed that underwriting criteria, and we appreciate our financial partners, and since we have to accelerate access to capital, we've actually, through the mayor's budget, put in $500,000 to support what would be the state's only black-owned financial cooperative in CDFI. That started as a result of a police-involved shooting, and understanding that the system has not been made for black and brown people to actually exist and to thrive. And by investing in this institution, it already has the trust of the community and has the support of organizations like our Minneapolis Regional Chamber of Commerce, the City of Minneapolis, a number of financial institutions, and our foundations. We think that we can close the gap on the unbanked, which means we can get more people into ownership, which means we can make sure that more people are stabilized in their housing, because we know that in these communities, their values are rising. And we often talk about home ownership. The reality is that we have tons of people in ownership in these communities that are predominantly people of color. But as the development goes up, they're already at the brink of really a breaking point because they can't afford increased taxes. Right? So there's a really important balancing dynamic to investments in the financial market, really demanding that our investors and that our philanthropists invest in the people, and then making sure that our policies are aligned in a way that continues to be that specific, racially specific, culturally specific, and geographically specific in the investments that we make.
Yeah, please.
So I'll talk about affordable housing and some of the policies that are at work to try to promote it and how they're counterproductive and inefficient. So fundamentally, what's happened, if you look at our region, and I'm assuming it has parallels in other parts of the country, is you have public dollars flowing into neighborhoods that are struggling, and you have private dollars flowing into neighborhoods that are improving and experiencing gentrification. The public dollars are working at odds with the private dollars, and the private dollars dwarf the public dollars. Then you have systems like low-income housing tax credits and housing choice vouchers that ironically serve to further concentrate poverty. So low-income housing tax credit programs are fundamentally complex, difficult, time-consuming to use, and they're the least desirable buyer of a property. So fundamentally, they end up going into properties that are already deeply concentrated in terms of poverty. They also revolve around building new units or doing massive renovations to existing units. New units are obviously much more expensive than existing units that are in good condition. So it'd be far more effective, if you're concerned about use of resources, to spend the money buying existing units in good neighborhoods rather than building brand new units in bad neighborhoods. Housing choice vouchers are an economist's dream. You'd think that would work beautifully. But as a matter of practice, landlords are not required, in effect, to take them. They're doled out by housing authorities, which are bureaucratic and difficult to work with. And so fundamentally, if you track where housing choice vouchers get used, that's Section 8 vouchers, they get used in predominantly poor neighborhoods. And then if last you look at inclusionary zoning, which in theory is about producing housing in good neighborhoods, that's all about building brand new units in the most expensive buildings in any market, the brand new luxury unit, which is at least double or triple what it would cost to buy a unit in that same neighborhood. So that is honestly a fundamental waste of those resources. It also drives up the cost of housing in that neighborhood by making it that much more expensive to build the new unit, which means rents go up. And the renter that pays those rents is usually a middle-income demographic. So you're fundamentally tagging the middle-income demographic with the needs of funding housing for low-income residents. So all these programs, in my view, are poorly structured and need massive revision. And I think this center can start to tackle those issues.
That's great. No, please, Alyssa. Yeah.
I just want to kind of pick up on the theme that I'm hearing here, which is sort of looking at some of the old tools in new ways and recognize that we've used our old tools for outcomes that really didn't benefit everybody. And we have an opportunity to change the way we use the tools, whether they're financial or, from my standpoint, more on the urban planning and infrastructure side. You know, Portland has been building light rail lines for decades now. And, you know, we have been known for sort of building communities through transit, or have we actually been known for building transit through communities? I think we have done some of both, and we've learned lessons so that instead of using a light rail line to change a demographic of a neighborhood, bring in new people, and force out old people, we are changing the way we do our infrastructure planning to do what we call investment areas. So when you're building a light rail line, as we are now in Southwest Corridor, one of the areas of our region that really needs transit, we're also wrapping around an equitable development strategy at the same time, looking at affordable housing, looking at stabilizing small businesses, looking at ways to actually bring private capital and other resources that complement the public dollar into the planning process, so that instead of ending up with a light rail project that benefits some and forces some out, has some of the real estate impacts that we've talked about here, you actually have the opportunity to link together some of the public and private investments in a more intentional way.
Yeah, I think we hear about this all the time across the country, how valuable these public transportation investments are when they're successful, and that's great. But how do we make sure that everyone can tap into it? And Sean, you're living in one of the districts or regions, if you will, that's successfully executing on these rail investments, right?
Absolutely. And I'd say the other theme to this previous question is changing the players or expanding to people who are at the table. And in my work, I like to keep in mind timelines, right? Infrastructure investments and this sort of transformative placemaking that we've all been highlighting takes like a decade or two sometimes. But the reality is opportunity zones is right now, right? All of these investment models are right now. Our money is happening right now, right? Bonding bills have a regular cycle. And so we can't figure out how to change the players and make sure that we have people who are most impacted at the table, then we already start to lose. And I think that's been in most evident in our transit investment conversations. And some people may know about the Green Line in the Twin Cities. This is also Southwest Light Rail and also now Botno, where our major transit projects are really planned to go right through communities of color. And yet the primary decision makers are not people of color. And so we spend a lot of time discovering the communities, figuring out the neighborhood characteristics, trying to identify the real estate. And part of our reality has been that in some of those transit corridors, the most amazing deals that are reflective of community have required the most creative structures, right? It's required new market tax credits. It's required partners like Target and others to come in and to lease entire floors. But it's also required us to have developers and business leaders who are of the community, because we need to turn around in a very short timeline a project that is actually reflective, affirming, and supportive of the values of the neighborhoods themselves. And so I think of transformative placemaking as a reclamation of that which was, right? The policies and procedures that have caused our country to get to its current state, those were actually acts of placemaking. It was placemaking to decide who could go where. It was placemaking to decide that black and brown people could not have permits in their own city. I'm originally from Chicago. And when I was growing up, I like to say I'm 22, but when I was growing up, you know, you were much more likely to see a white or Arab owner of a business than a black owner of a business in my black community. That's not very different right now, right? And some of that's about system navigation, but there's also the reality that when we try to make investments, we all think about those timelines and we default to the people that we think understand how to get it done and who have projects and practices and policies that reflect the thing that we know will be successful. And success, I think, in this era is fundamentally different.
Right. I want to shift gears a little bit because I do want to talk about agglomeration and scale here, because that's such a powerful tool of placemaking, right? I think what's been so powerful today is making the case of how people need to be at the center, but our policies aren't working. But there's a lot of design innovation that we have that is working, right? So this is not meant to be just a pity party, right? It also, there's a lot of positive energy here too. So again, I keep picking on you, Patrice. I keep starting down here. But I want to hear about, I think we tend to think of it oftentimes as big city. I think the video, which you, nice feature role, and then what Jennifer's talking about, right? This can work at different scales. Digitalization can work in small communities, not just big ones, right? What are some of the design innovations you've worked with over 2,000 communities, right, your organization over 30 years? What have been some of the coolest innovations, right, that have helped galvanize people to come to the same kind of places and become better neighbors?
Yeah. Well, I love, Sean, your idea of placemaking as reclamation. I think that is fundamentally the practice that we're involved in at the National Main Street Center, which isn't to say that there aren't really cool new twists on that. But I think, you know, if you look at the way cities evolved over 6,000 years, there's a lot of wisdom there. And if you look at many of our rural communities, there are just fantastic bones to build on there. I mean, not to repeat everything that was said, but, you know, they're dense, they're walkable, they have great buildings. They're built at a scale that is human and accessible and charming. That's a lot to build on. So, you know, when we see communities succeed, it's because they understand that that's an asset, and they're committed to putting those back into active use. And I would also argue, picking up on some of the themes of the earlier conversation, you know, that engagement, the community engagement piece, is probably the single most important thing. It's making sure that you've got everyone at the table. You're going out of your way to get folks who maybe didn't feel welcome before, didn't see themselves as part of, you know, the downtown, and making sure that they're present.
Yeah, I mean, Portland, this is the positive charm, right? We were joking before this, and Alyssa and I know each other a little bit. You fly into Portland, you take the light rail, it beautifully slows down. Maybe we'll talk about that slowdown in a second. But you get this view of this really true, I mean, placemaking success at a grand scale. Really at, you know, this is Jennifer's word, right? Now we're talking a district, right? This is a full-on district that's successful. How have you seen that emanate through the community as a success story?
Well, it's interesting, the view that the tourists see as they come in through downtown in the light rail, which is exactly what we want you to see, the beautiful sort of placemaking from the ground up, reclaiming old brownfields and all of that. But there's parts of town that you don't see when you take the light rail because they're not served by transit well. That's where people have been displaced to from the neighborhoods that you've seen rise up. And so one of the things we're doing as a regional government, I think, is kind of an interesting idea. We have a creative placemaking program in which we are essentially handing the decision-making power and the knowledge and the belief that the ideas are coming from the community themselves. We're giving small grants to communities who have suffered displacement, immigrant communities, with the idea that when people have the resources and the access to make the decisions themselves, it changes completely sort of their investment in and commitment to the place. It also strengthens their ability to participate in the civic infrastructure when they have the access to the resources, when they're making the decisions, and when the governments are trusting that the communities have the ideas and the power to actually make the places themselves. So I can go further about that, but I think that's a program that is working incredibly well and sort of waking people up to the fact that the solutions aren't from the government, and they are from the community. So there's nothing more powerful than inviting an elected official to come to Tonga Day and see the community celebrating their heritage. Or we just had the launch of the first Native American canoe building. And again, inviting local elected officials to that is kind of a sort of top-down way or bottom-up way of saying we're changing the way who has the power and who's making the place.
Yeah, Rob, I want you to weigh in on this too, because I feel like this is one of the most exciting things about DC is a recognition of just how well, whether it's between the bones of this, right, this 19th century plan to, right, the scale of the place, of how much we've seen densification in the region, especially in some of these kind of places that, or let's call it neighborhoods or districts that have the place-centric assets that are really valuable.
Right. So I guess I'd make one comment to start, and that is that I personally believe that agglomeration and scale are two characteristics that are going to drive growth in these major cities for decades. And if you look at our country, it's driven by the knowledge worker, it's driven by the knowledge economy. There are good reasons in a world where your job is not permanent and where both members of a family work to pick a jurisdiction or a city that has the prospect of lifetime employment. So I think that we need to accept the fact that that's going to be a reality. And then we have to do a better job of absorbing people who come from less productive parts of the country into those economies. And I think at the moment what we're doing is we're allowing the incumbents via a zoning process that's evolved over 30 years to defend their turf and to protect value for themselves at the expense of new entrants. So if over my career, I've watched the zoning process go from a very simple process where you literally applied for a permit and 12 months later you got it. It was simple. You built an office building, you built an apartment building, something pretty boring, prosaic, and fundamentally it was done at fairly low cost. Over 30 years, you've had a zoning process that was more public, involved a lot more time, all of which are good things, the public involvement, but became much more complex, time-consuming, and opaque. And the risk involved in getting an entitlement now in an urban environment, and typically in the places where there's the greatest demand, has gone through the roof. So it all gets reflected in higher rents and higher costs. So in my view, we need, and it's very hard to do because zoning is a local matter in America. So it's going to require an education that, honestly, Brookings and others are going to need to go do across the country to change a process that has become a really cumbersome and a regressive process, and make it much more effective in the sense of shortening the time frame. So a very simple description of the process, the way I'd like to see it, is you have a five-year comprehensive plan in which you have demand met under the comprehensive plan for housing from all demographics and all the uses. So fundamentally, it's intentionally planning that revolves around creating mixed-income communities. And then you have a stipulated maximum on zoning timeframes of a year, and you stipulate the exactions and the proffers up front so you find out before you start the process what it's likely to cost you in the way of exactions. Those simple changes would drop the risk dramatically and would allow us to be much more responsive to market demand and to meet needs on a more timely basis. Now, ironically, I'm a developer, so you might think, well, that sounds like a classic developer looking to, you know, grease the skids. In fact, developers make money due to this process. The reality is all the complexity and the risk and all the rate creates scarcity, and scarcity creates value and greater profit. So when we get through that process, of course, we never want the rules to apply to us. We want them to apply to everybody else. But fundamentally, if we get through that process, we have something really valuable in the form of our entitlements. So in fact, it'd be the development impoverishment scheme if you did this. But I personally think that it's a huge step that's needed if we're going to like change this dynamic.
Yeah, sure.
You know, that process would catapult us to like top city in the nation. So please, let's make that happen. You know, one of our realities is that placemaking is an anti-developer, right? Some of our best strategists, some of the best people at the table are actually the developers. To be able to reflect to us the tedious nature of getting through the process is really important. And for all of the challenges that we have, our region is doing quite a few things pretty well, quite amazingly. One, our Regional Economic Development Organization, our EDO, Greater MSP, is increasingly inclusive. And also, that's critical because that's the place where our business leaders actually are, right? It's a really different conversation. We start having placemaking in the public sector, or we're having it with our nonprofits, or we're talking about it with our developers. When the owners of the Fortune 500s and the Fortune 250s say that it matters, it matters. That's what it means to be market-driven. The other piece, I'd say we're in a really transformative place as a region. The other piece is we have new leadership in our chambers. And I know for us, our Minneapolis Regional Chamber of Commerce is absolutely rocking it, right? They're amazing partners with us when it comes to advocating for a fully built-out transit system and what it means that our public sector invests, what, $9 billion, and has invested $9 billion in that, and what it looks like for our cities to actually show up and advocate. But we also have these amazing partnerships with your everyday people. We really have moved beyond the sort of legacy institutions, still partnering with them, into a place where kind of the person that would normally show up or send you an email and say, hey, I have a great idea, is now at the table with us. So I mentioned the investment in Village Financial Cooperative. Please look them up. They're phenomenal. That's the financial cooperative that's popping up. And we're also working on establishing cultural districts. So there's a natural tension, I think, between going hyper-focused on a district or a neighborhood and what that means when a city does that across, or a county does it across the county. And so we're really focusing on cultural districts throughout the city.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up this point. There's one place I want to go today, which is the presence of business asking for these kind of design features, right? How are we all seeing that in your respective communities? You just talked about one that famously kind of talked about some of the assets they were looking for, but how is that positively influencing, you're hearing, the placemaking efforts on the ground, right? To have the business community be asking, these are the kind of design features we want to see, because it's going to help us attract talent, it's going to help us grow our business.
Well, I'll start and say that businesses move faster than we do. Right, that's made a lot of difference. On opportunity zones, partnering with our business community has allowed us to develop and run capital stack scenarios to figure out what the investment might look like, how to get funds into the deal, what projects come out the other end, how we might actually leverage opportunity zones, for example, to invest in those micro enterprises, those places where we know we're going to see the most growth over the next 5 to 10 years. And then the partnerships, again, around changing the way that we're thinking about affordable housing. It has been critical to have them at our tables there, because we have all of the great ideas, but from a development standpoint, really understanding the pro forma, thinking through the process, and then saying to our private sector leaders who are already in partnership, you know, hey, we have a prioritization of hiring people of color. Are you willing to go with us? Even around some of our state incentives, and that's where a lot of our incentives come from, our major companies, we're embarking on a process right now where we're saying to companies, we want to support your process. We want to have you in the city of Minneapolis. We think that you'll be successful here. We have the workforce that you want. We have the transportation that you want. We need your help making sure that we have the workforce that we all need. Will you make these investments if you make those investments, and we'll support your request for funding? So it's been helpful to have them at the table and guide our policy, but also have buy-in at a level that they usually get to opt out.
Yeah, Patrice, how are you seeing this at the kind of smaller town scale, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the smaller town scale, it's a little bit different. But I would say I'm struck by two things. One, you know, referencing the conversation a bit earlier, I think there's a big role for even small town governments to just get out of the way sometimes. That there is, you know, that there's. And we often think that you need enormous amounts of capital to make the changes that we're describing here. And that's the perfect no cost sort of, like, just make the process easier and you'll see better outcomes flow from that. You know, I think the other thing that we see is in our Main Street districts, like, if you listen to the businesses, they will tell you what they need to help create a better place. And particularly having them involved in a smaller scale setting, you know, we see where that really produces better outcomes on the ground.
I want to transition from here to some innovations, which I think is, you know, to really make it positive sounding. Alyssa, some people in this room right now, many probably don't. There was a very big vote in Portland. Well, there's a big governor vote in the state, too. There's, of course, House races. But there's a very important vote in Portland, right, that folks may not know about. I think it's probably a really innovative solution here, especially in our bigger coastal, high-tech, magnet markets, right, to solve the housing challenge.
Yes, but it doesn't speak to government getting out of the way.
No.
It speaks to government getting in the middle. But it's to your point earlier of sort of what are we hearing from the business community. And while I think the Portland region sort of has Fortune 500 envy for some of the other regions, you might have envy of us for traffic, for example. But it's getting worse, and the business community is telling us that. But one of the things that we are hearing, too, as you said and you said, is the need for affordable housing and sort of the recognition that the growth that we're having is just not keeping up with the affordability needs for the workers in the region. And so what Adi is referring to is the Metro Regional Government, where I work, is the only elected regional government in the country. And our council referred to voters this year an affordable housing general obligation bond measure, the third largest bond measure in the state of Oregon. And it passed this past week, which was a huge accomplishment for us. It gives us $650 million to invest in affordable housing. And to try to close the gap of affordability that we have seen in our region and try to address those who are being left behind by the market and also those in the middle who are looking for a place to work and live who are on the edge. And while it is not as much as we need, it recognizes sort of an interesting partnership in doing something at a regional scale and actually trying to solve a problem that isn't just the central city's problem, that isn't just the suburbs' problem, that isn't just the good neighborhoods versus the bad neighborhoods, but recognizes that in order to solve affordable housing, it's going to take a regional approach at a regional scale.
Please.
So we, our firm, working with the Federal City Council here in Washington, has developed a fund which is arguably innovative, and it's essentially organized around the notion that if we combine philanthropic capital and private capital, without necessarily using public capital, that we can use it, we can make a dent in the affordable housing problem in our region. And the basic idea is to form a not-for-profit to own the properties, to raise all the money from financial players at fixed rates so that all the benefits of the acquisitions that we make and the growth in value and the growth in rents all inure to the benefit of the not-for-profit. The fund will be about $150 million, we hope. We have increased the size of it due to the Amazon win, because Amazon's likely to have some negative impacts on that front. And by the way, they were very much drawn to this notion, and I think it was one of the factors in their choosing Crystal City. But the basic idea is to harness the cheapest sorts of capital. So we worked with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to deliver discounted terms. We are working with program-related investment foundations. We're working with banks using CRA capital. And then we've structured it in a manner that minimizes the payment of taxes and involves a tax deduction for any donation to the not-for-profit. So the basic idea is to create a pool of capital that's as nimble and flexible and fast-moving as the private capital with which we're competing. And our focus is going to be on buying apartments in improving neighborhoods As opposed to building them, we'll only build them if we can get the land for free, in essence, because it's too expensive to build, per my earlier comments. And the notion is to fundamentally, using our cost of capital advantage, take the disparity between our lower cost of capital and the market rate cost of capital and drive that into rent reductions and services. So it's a sort of a simple, you know, I could call it financial engineered approach to doing this, which I think has implications for policy, because you could substitute the philanthropic capital with public capital. Now, the irony is, anytime we've ever used public capital, the constraints on using it, the time involved in getting it, and the ongoing involvement in dealing with that, whatever the government is, have been worth less than the free capital. So fundamentally, our approach right now does not involve using that. But we have some thoughts on how to do that in a way that's flexible and works. And I actually feel like that is an innovation per se that might actually bear fruit.
Yeah, Patrice and Sean, you have some innovations that you want to kind of discuss.
Go ahead, Sean. Yeah, you know, I was thinking of the reality that sometimes when you're in it, it doesn't feel like an innovation. And our way of structuring deals right now is very much aligned with this idea. And I'd say it's been the greatest manifestation of public-private civic partnerships in a real way, where our ballpark owners, our Fortune 500s again, but even our small companies have come together to start to create the set of criteria that we would use to do things like designate opportunity zones, to think about what our procurement policies are as a city, and to say, you know, we're going to be at the table with you, City of Minneapolis, Hennepin County, and even in St. Paul, as you start to deploy and really evaluate these. But what's so amazing and the more innovative side of that is our institutions like LISC, for example, have really stepped up in some scenarios where owners and developers of color have really been treated with incredible discrimination. And so for a prosperous city like Minneapolis, our innovation is I think largely around people using their social capital in ways that they've never used it before. To really risk and to go to the friends and other owners and say, hey, you know, we work with these folks, we work with this community on a regular basis. We will put up our personal collateral to support this project because we know it's going to be successful, has made all of the difference. And then the last piece is really a new set of investments around patient capital, because everything that we have left is really about patient capital.
Yeah. I'd say, I think, some of the bigger innovation I've seen in the rural space actually has to do more with entrepreneurship and the way that that's concentrating on downtowns or in walkable districts in rural places. And I think slowly local decision makers, civic leaders are starting to understand that the old model of smokestack chasing for rural communities doesn't work. It also, PS doesn't work for big cities, but you know, there are fewer and fewer industries out there that are going to be willing to relocate to a rural community. So the growth that rural communities are going to see is going to come primarily from two things. One, it is making sure you're hanging on to what you got, and quality of place is absolutely essential to that. That is what's going to help your local employers hang on to and attract new talent. And then the other thing is cultivating local entrepreneurs in your midst. And we see great promise there. We're starting to do a lot more work on that. But I would add, I think there are strong parallels between supporting entrepreneurs in the rural context and supporting them in the urban context. So I think there's a lot of cross-learning and innovation that can happen there.
You know, that's a really good point. I was thinking of what our innovative sector, our sort of entrepreneurs look like now. We have a lot of tech workers, of course, but agriculture is actually huge. Food and ag is huge in our region. And in our communities that are largely communities of color, where we have a lot of the new transit investments, there's actually a really strong production and processing component in food and ag sector. And increasingly, in all of our deals throughout the city, our environmental justice communities are at the table. And traditionally, in many of our cities, including here in D.C., I was behind the scenes for some of those protests and others, but the environmental justice community has really been the base of antagonizers, the base of protesters. And I think that is a valuable and valid place to be. And increasingly in the Twin Cities, they're the deal makers and the developers and the business owners and the workforce trainers. And so they've brought a new framework to this relationship, like thinking about the farm bill. A number of people in our region actually helped to write the recent farm bills. That's huge. And they bring that to our conversation about how we structure deals. We're also a part of the Mississippi River Cities and Towns Initiative, which is a partnership of the cities along the Mississippi. And now we're one of seven cities that have been chosen to develop this infrastructure fund along the Mississippi, which is really about flood mitigation and environmental impacts. But our city is one of the few that has a 48-acre redevelopment site right on the Mississippi, also in an opportunity zone. And it is our environmental justice community that is at the table with us thinking about how that gets structured and how our MPO could partner with us around even district energy. So it's a very different and unique type of placemaking. And these are, I mean, for folks that aren't as familiar with environmental justice communities, these are the communities that have experienced the heaviest pollution. They're often the communities that the highways run through, and 95% of the time they are communities of color until you get into Appalachia and similar places.
Okay, I'm going to go to Alyssa, but then we're going to go to the audience for questions, so get them ready. Alyssa, we'll get the last comment here.
I just wanted to throw in one more thing, because we're very real estate and urban planning focused here, and the premise of this conversation was to talk about people. And so I just wanted to throw in one more thing that I think is important around sort of this placemaking and innovation is the role of arts and culture. And I think we're seeing that a lot. I think it applies in big cities. It applies in small towns. And again, not just, you know, government putting up a sculpture or a corporation putting up a sculpture, but really sort of, you know, letting the communities lead the conversation about the arts and culture that, like, connects them to their sense of place. We've seen it as a tool for healing from gentrification and displacement, where art and culture actually allow people to express themselves in a public forum around some of the pain that's been caused to them. And again, it's such a community building tool, and it's such a place, a way of creating identity, not just for something that you ride in on and see as a tourist, but for the people who have to live there every single day. So I just want to put that out there.
Can you say, though, because this is really important, arts and culture. I was up at 3 o'clock in the morning on this one. What do you mean when you say culture? Because we might, in this room, we might have about 100 different definitions. What do you guys really mean when you say arts and culture in that framework?
Well, so what we mean is really letting the communities tell us, right? We are essentially saying, it's your place. You tell us what gives you the ownership of and the connection to and the sense of ownership and investment in this place. We don't dictate the solutions. What we say is, actually, what they tell us is nothing for us without us. And so that's what we really mean is, it comes from you, not from us.
That's a beautiful place to get a last comment. Okay, so I see the two hands over here, gentlemen that are near each other. You're going to get my first two calls, but I'm just telling for everyone, please say who you are, and as Brookings policy, please end with a question mark, if you will, even if you want to make a comment.
Thank you.
The word question.
Real quick, European extraction architect and planner, funny name. Two quick questions. Has the shared taxing in Minneapolis helped with inclusion and inclusionary policies? Second question to Rob is, can affordable housing be built at scale by taking advantage of modular, prefab, off-site? Because the affordable units at Edison and 2M in Noma, I think, are a joke and a waste. Thank you.
Nice. I'll keep it short and say I think it has us on our way. Like I said before, I think as a region, we really are starting to move away from the us and them mentality into a we're all in it together, and that goes along with the shared taxing.
And with regard to modular housing, affordable housing, in my view, should mostly be bought, not built. So I'm not sure that the techniques have that much relevance if it was done, again, in my view, properly. But, and I think secondly, affordable housing is just like market rate housing fundamentally. So to the extent that modular housing becomes predominant in market rate housing, it's going to find its way into affordable housing. I do think that little by little you're seeing that happen. And if you look at the national home builders, lots of their work is done in factories and carted to the site. So it's happening slowly, but I think it is ultimately going to have big impacts.
Okay, let's go to these two gentlemen back there. Yeah. Thank you, Karen.
My name's Kenneth Otto. I'm a student at Daniel Morgan Graduate School of National Security. There was a talk about art and culture. I'm passionate about art and business, but the field of intelligence also creates opportunities for that as well. Yeah, art and culture is important, but gentrification happens in arts and culture too. You know what I mean? Especially, I come from Brooklyn, New York, so there's a lot of gentrification that occurs there, and typically art, you know, real estate investment trust and, you know, private players, they come into these communities and they're like, oh yeah, well, let's invest in arts and culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that they don't feel upset that we're pushing them out. But then they gentrify the arts and culture too. And so now it's not authentic. Even the art and culture, the way of life of people that were indigenous to, like, let's say Brooklyn, for example, it gentrifies that as well. So how can there be like agency of indigenous people, not just from the real estate side, the placemaking side, but the art and culture side too? Because that's where your home is, where you put your hat, you know what I mean? And so it has no four walls to that. Even your home is your culture, and your art is your home too, and your place. So can any of you speak to that?
I just wanted to, I agree with everything you said, and I'm so glad you brought it up. I just wanted to talk about an example of sort of how we've tried to put our money where our mouth is, where we can, knowing the role that we play as a regional government. And in that placemaking program that I mentioned earlier, one of the grants we gave was to a group called Art Save My Life, essentially run by young African-American people in the community, basically to talk about how art saved their life as they dealt with gentrification and displacement. They've done performance art, they've put on musical events, they actually provide a residency for someone to live 1 year in a house in the neighborhood that is gentrifying, and just make art and perform and share it with the community. And so I think it's a great way to sort of take the next generation of people from that community and talk about how art really saves their life and can be a tool for healing and communication and education so that it doesn't keep happening.
Mm. Kenneth, right?
Yes.
Nice to meet you. So I think it's helpful to know my background, right? I do economic development because I believe it's a public health opportunity. Oftentimes we talk about arts, culture, and racial justice and economic justice, and it's squarely over there, but the built environment is like the path of the dollars. So the way that we're addressing this, and this is why I asked the question, right? Because I have this debate with my colleagues all the time. The reason I asked the question is because arts and culture does exactly what you said, particularly when it's done for a community by people not of that community, or with a prioritization of folks that typically have the voice and the agency and the ownership to get access to the resources to do the thing that's already qualified as art. And then we call it culture because that's more socially acceptable right now across the country. So we're doing things a bit differently, right? And I ask, because hey, team, we could talk about arts and culture all day, but when we talk about culture, we're talking about people of color. And since that gets conflated, we're just going to say people of color. And when people get confused, we're going to say black and indigenous and new American or immigrant community so that we're really clear who we're talking about. And we have the data to back it. So that's where first things first, right? And then the investment in community and in arts and culture in that community should be through black, indigenous, new American communities, point blank, right? In Brooklyn, it should have been Brooklyn folks that were doing that art, right? In Chicago, there's a reason why Theaster Gates is important and not all of the other artists that have popped up and done this sort of placemaking. That's really the prioritization. We always say, you know, it's great to have to make the investments and then assume that the communities are going to benefit. But we're really talking about who benefits first, right? Don't come up and throw a mural on the side of the building or make an amazing sculpture. It's about the art is also about the design of the streets. The art is also about urban acupuncture, right? Like what kind of grass you're using. The art is in considering edible landscaping when you're making your transit investments and making sure that we do that in a culturally responsive way, but not like come up with a great idea and then take it to the community. Ask the folks who are already there. You know, we're investing in cooperatives right now as a city. We're investing in people who already do this work because it's going to take us exponentially longer to figure out how to do it if it's not the thing that we already do. So I think to your question, long story short, start with the people who are already in place. And if you're a person that has access and sits at that table, then it's actually your opportunity and your responsibility to say, you know what, I'm going to step out of this role and I'm going to support somebody else owning this project and making the decisions for their community.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to the gentleman right next to you, Karen, and then I promise I will go on, with, like, right in front of you. Right, no. Didn't you have... Yes, sorry.
Oh, hello. Hi, my name is Claudia Farris. It was said here at the very beginning that the worst place in the world to grow up is in a poor neighborhood. Now, I have a undergraduate degree in physics. I have a master's degree from the Harvard Business School, and I have a PhD in complexity science from George Mason. Hello? I'm not saying that those restrictions aren't there, but the love and the support and the power of my family gave me the foundation that I needed to deal with anything. The people in these neighborhoods don't see themselves as poor. They see themselves as I see myself, full of possibilities, full of potential, full of ability to give and serve and make things better. Now, I am a member of a church that owns property, owns the property around it. My pastor has a transformative placemaking mindset. He wants to put low-income housing on that property. He's charged me with putting that together. Hello. I went on the web looking for people who think like I thought placemaking, transformative placemaking people think, and I found a guy named Walter Hook Hood. Thank you. Y'all heard of him. Okay? I'm amazed that he's not on this panel. I saw him. Hello? I know. Amazing. Look him up on the web. What is it? It's a TED Talk. Mm-hmm. His TED Talk is outstanding. So I wanted to know who that community was so I could get the support I need to take this corner of Southeast Washington, D.C. and make it transformative for the people in the neighborhood. That's why I'm here. Okay?
Thank you.
And I hope to find you people somewhere. The question I have, however, is because I'm hearing a lot of mindsets from all of you special, wonderful, experienced people. However, y'all got fixed mindsets about what it is. My question is, what would happen if we were to think of scale as scaled? Look for the diversity in the issue of scale, because everything is somewhere. And the scale, what works at that scale of, you know, I don't even know what. But we need to understand more what the diversity of scale is so that we can look at our policy structuring in terms of what's natural and not try to impose our preconceived notions of what works and what's good over here to what works and what's good over there. You know? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. I think this one of scale is really important. Jennifer brought it up in her initial presentation, right? How can we think about the scale differently? And frankly, to the opening comment on making sure we have a liquidity of idea generation, right? And this is one of my questions too. How do we make sure that people know what good ideas are out there and they get information so they can help redevelop place in whatever scale they're looking at?
Ms. Claudia, right? Thank you. So from my standpoint, that is the work. That's the work. And that's what I mean when I say getting out of the way, right? Like I work with a lot of folks who already have the money and the access and the power and the whole thing. But I grew up in a place like you, right? When people were hungry on my block, like our families cooked so that the kids could eat. All right. You know, I grew up in a family that put on the functions and that sort of thing. And that is what makes the ground fertile for thriving. And so I guess from my perspective, the work that I do and that we do in the city of Minneapolis under Mayor Fry's leadership isn't about imposing new ideas. It's actually about helping people remember that they've already done it, that it's a part of our blood memory, that it's our ancestral truth, and that our resources need to be invested in that. So we have like a huge, this is like a really basic example. We have a huge biking infrastructure in our city. And when we had a lot of white bikers who were coming into the city and they wanted to put on a bike lane. Everyone's like, why are you putting a bike lane there when you haven't figured out policing, right? And then we started hearing, well, black people don't bike. I was like, whoa, that's not true. We do bike. Oh, black people don't grow. Well, that's not true. Black people don't own businesses. Well, how do you think we've survived? Because for most of the history of this country, nobody's been giving us anything, right? So from my standpoint, it is not about imposing, but it's about recognizing, again, recognizing that Black and Indigenous communities have had to exist outside of the dominant framework from the beginning of time. And right now, we're in a place of degradation as a country. I'll just be honest, this is my perspective, not that of the mayor, right? And so that means we should go to the communities that have been able to thrive, survive, and be innovative from the beginning and invest there. That's really what I'm saying. It's not about saying, oh, we're going to come with a new fund structure and we're going to help you succeed. It's about erasing the fact that we need that fund structure to begin with.
Anyone else?
I'll just say I think the Claudia highlighted the dangers of generalizing in this space, and that I think one of the things we have the opportunity to do through the Bass Center is to really understand the texture, the complexity, the different things that are happening in different kinds of places, and elevate those as models that can be replicated or not that you know, be completely open to new ways of generating good quality places.
Yes. Thank you, Claudia. Let's go right here and, yep, perfect, thank you.
Hi, thank you. I'm Angela Adams. I direct the public art program for Arlington, Virginia. And in response to Claudia's request for Walter Hood, I just want to say that our program has brought Walter Hood to Arlington to do his first project in the entire metro area, working with NOC, which is a traditionally African-American community. And actually, in response to Sean, what you were saying about working with local talent, I just want to say in this case, I decided I wanted the very best for NOC. So we've brought Walter in because we thought we could facilitate the best possible outcome from a design perspective. But at the same time, it inspired a local artist to go through the process of applying for a grant for the first time and receiving one from our Arts Commission. So I think there's something to be had from bringing artists in who can elicit the best of community, but also inspire community that maybe hasn't awoken to what is possible for them.
That's that reflection.
Okay. Let's go to the gentleman in the back. Thank you.
Richard Hoy. I come from a background of an impoverished neighborhood in Potomac, Maryland. And I went to a high school in Montgomery County that is on the west side in Potomac. And that was a very challenging life. And I kid you not, because what we talk about, when we talk about affordable housing and revitalizing communities, I'd like to hear the panelists talk about metrics. The isolation that I felt in a very wealthy, car-dependent, and very white enclave in the western part of a very diverse county was an experience that I only realized until I left it and went to a small town in western Maryland where I went to college briefly and experienced volunteering in the town for the fire department and ambulance service, where I was sitting in a meeting like this with people of every kind of persuasion, and we were all invested in each other, and our thoughts and ideas and contributions mattered. And when we left, we would encounter each other on the street. I could never experience that in the place that I lived in. So that's a metric of poverty. And so I'd like to hear you all speak about what are the metrics that pull in these ideas so that we can describe place and the accomplishment of placemaking with tools that go beyond our biases and the limitations of our own perspectives.
Great, thank you.
I can start there, and we have one very direct measurement. So at Main Street, we measure all the kind of things that you would expect, jobs, new businesses, but we also measure volunteer hours, precisely because of what you're describing, which is that notion of community engagement, community participation is so very important. So we look at that as a really vital statistic about the quality, you know, the quality of the place, the quality of the placemaking happening there. And I thank you for your question, because I think one of the things that we haven't touched on today are the sort of psychological impacts as humans when, you know, we live in places that aren't conducive to us having positive relationships with other people.
Yes, anyone else? And I want to amplify that point. I've stayed as out of the way as possible, but growing up in a state like Florida, we know exactly what it's like to grow up behind either technically walled or unwalled subdivisions, separated from everyone. Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone come to life every day, and it is real. And I think Jennifer brought it up in her opening presentation. So if anyone has even specific comments on that, we talked, I think, a lot more often through an urban context today. But what does it mean to have that kind of suburban isolation, whether through a health point to Patrice or just in general, right, aesthetically? How are we going to respond to that almost like lack of place that we created?
Spawned a whole generation of urbanists. Yeah, right. Anyone else here from the suburbs?
I think a slightly different perspective on it, or I like to discern a couple of things. There's the reality of growing up in a place maybe that is reflective of you. Some of us draw that at racial lines. Some of us draw that at racial and economic lines. But a place where you have a sense of belonging, I think, is the other side of what we're talking about right now. And you can live in a place that's reflective and never have a sense of belonging. I found that most people of color and community report, even if they're living in isolation racially or economically, a sense of belonging. And so I think it's the modeling, the replication of belonging that really is the deficit. A lot of the cultural appropriation, other things that take place, is because people don't have that thing to grab hold of. And so the metric, what is the metric there? Part of what makes a village financial cooperative successful is that people make an investment and they're like, oh, that's my place. I may never have a dime that I can put in that bank, but I know that the people that are there speak my language and connect me to something else. And then they come to the events like you described, and then they hear a different perspective. But in a time, I think, where our country is so full of fear and where people are so exhausted, it's important that we all create the places where we are affirming people, you know, like deeply affirming people. You know, I would say to some of my folks I work with, you can say something. It might be racist, but we'll work through that later. I actually just need to know what you think and what you feel. Because if we can have a real conversation and we can really wrestle with what you believe to be true, then we can start solving things. So I think the first metric is the ability to actually be honest. Right. The ability to then say, I might be wrong. That's an important metric. One of the metrics we gloss over in this work is failing. Someone mentioned that in an earlier presentation. That's an important metric because it's also a metric of how many times you tried. Failure is a metric of how many times you tried and how far you went. So those are a few things to consider, but actually creating a space is really, really important.
Yeah. Rob, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah. I'm the plumber on the stage, so I'm thinking about solutions. I think that both of the comments that were made illustrate a point, a fundamental point, which should be a principle of planning, which is that mixing incomes is a public good. Yes. And that we all benefit from exposure to a diversity of incomes. And people in general, and this gets to the core of the center, there's going to be a growing power in these places. And these places are going to be dense. They're going to have all the best retail. Retail is going to migrate away from being warehouses with stuff all over the place and into showrooms that are linked, in my view, to the online presence. And those two are going to be symbiotic. You're going to have less of it, but it's going to be more powerful. And you're going to want people to live around it. And you're not going to want it to be people that have all entirely consist of the highest income people who are driving the most sales. So in order to make that happen, we've got to recognize that mixing incomes is a public good. And then we have to embed in an efficient way the subsidies in our system that basically produce that result. Because right now, that's not happening. And so it's you're going to get a structurally increasing concentration of wealth. In my view, autonomous vehicles are going to make that even worse. So I think that we have to recognize that and then start to change the system. And then I personally think that the system that's most responsive to what people want is one that allocates responsibility to various players based on their ability to do the work best. So government should be there to fund subsidies and provide resources. It should not be there to implement. It's not a particularly efficient implementer of those solutions. Developers should build buildings and they should stay out of arts and culture and all the rest. We're not good at it. And then the nonprofit community needs to be sustained in a committed way to manage those interventions. And not-for-profits live hand-to-mouth, and they're constantly fundraising. In my view, public dollars sent in that direction around making these places inclusive and managing the public spaces and all the rest is an important part of the answer, because it places the responsibility for managing those things in a group that has a mission around doing that and can be around for a long period of time and can be responsive to public interest. So.
You unfortunately, we're out of time. I think Rob, you might have been watching your watch. Subconsciously, no, you were like right on time. So that was amazing. And I think, frankly, those last two answers were perfectly emblematic of the challenges that face the country at a place level, at higher, the metro scale, of course, nationally, the challenges facing the VAST Center to take on this really challenging work, and how much inextricably people and the physicality of place are tied together. So join me in thanking the panel for their time and their candor. And then I want to thank all of you for spending your time with us on what looks like through the shades a beautiful day outside. So thank you again, and we'll see you at another public event here at Brookings.